We've learned a lot about how our bodies work, but we've only recently turned our attention to the things that are not technically us, but that certainly help our bodies work. Our bodies are occupied by countless hardworking microorganisms. Our guest today studies the organisms living inside other organisms and how they influence the health and behavior of the host animals. She's the director of the META Center at the University of Oregon. That stands for the Microbial Ecology and Theory of Animals Center for Systems Biology. The purpose of the META Center is to understand how host microbe systems work and use the knowledge to advance human health. Dr. Karen Gilliman is at the helm of this endeavor, and she's our guest today. Dr. Gilliman, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Germ theory apparently started with us thinking about sickness. Louis Pasteur et al. When did we come up with the idea that microbes actually keep us healthy?
You know, there was early ideas about that as well. In fact, Louis Pasteur was also aware of beneficial microbes. He was really an incredibly brilliant microbiologist, and he came up with ideas about how certain germs could cause disease, but he also was aware, for example, that there were really important microorganisms of yeasts that, maybe he didn't know that then, but that were actually important in production of beer and wine. And this was, of course, a very important industry in France. And so he was aware that there were beneficial microbes involved in human activities very early on, and actually postulated that humans might have beneficial microbes that would support life. So that idea of microbes that can be good for us as well as bad for us has really been around since the origin of microbiology. In fact, so the earliest microbes that were observed were in the late 1600s, a pioneering microscopist, von Leeuwenhoek, was able to develop lenses by just crafting lenses that could magnify materials enough to be able to actually see something the size of a microscopic microorganism. And the first microbes that he observed were actually he took cheek swabs and saliva from his mouth, and he noticed that there were these little particles that were moving around in a way that looked really animated, and he called these animalcules, and those were some of our normal resident oral microbes.
So right from the very beginning then, and once we knew a little bit about microbes, we realized that we had some living inside of us.
Yeah. So it was this incredible, you can sort of imagine this aha moment that there were these things inside his mouth that were alive.
I still remember my seventh grade science teacher saying, talking about Leeuwenhoek and saying that he looked into the microscope the first time and went, "Ah, what is this?"
Yeah.
Which is probably not the actual reaction. But.
Yes.
So what are some of the examples of ways in which microbes do help us? I mean, it sounds like they're certainly present in lots of our bodies, if not all of them.
Yes. So one of the things that we're really interested in how microbes modulate our immune responses. So our immune systems are very poised to detect microbes, and we have important defenses that our immune systems have developed to thwart the growth of microbes. But we also, have always coexisted with microbes, so, all animals evolved in a microbial world. And so one thing that we're appreciating is that microbes actually play a role in setting the immune status balance. And one way that we can look at this in our systems is that we look at animals that are devoid of all microorganisms. And we use the zebrafish as a model system where we do a lot of this work. And so we can make sterile, what in the field is referred to as germ-free, although we don't really think of them as germs, but zebrafish, and we look at how their immune systems develop versus ones that have their normal complement of microbes. And the germ-free animals have a less mature, less stimulated immune system, and so that tells us that the normal state of just normal health actually involves some kind of immune stimulation that's important. And then one thing that we've been able to do with our germ-free animals is we can ask, well, how do individual particular microbes stimulate the immune system by taking the initially sterile animals and just inoculating them with a single microorganism, one of the many members of the gut microbial communities of these animals. And we've been able to learn that different microbes stimulate that immune system differently. And so we're starting to get a picture of how you might build up a community that elicits the right amount of stimulation.
Dr. Karen Gilliman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a molecular biologist and director of the Meta Center at the University of Oregon, the Microbial Ecology and Theory of Animals Center for Systems Biology. You can see why it's called the Meta Center. Join us. Questions, comments, thoughts about microbes and what they do inside our bodies, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. How difficult is that to create an environment in which there are no microbes inside the zebrafish?
So it's in principle quite challenging, and we actually can't raise these zebrafish up through adulthood and breed them. But one of the advantages is that the embryos develop outside of the mother, as opposed to a mammal where they develop in utero. So the method that we use is simply just to surface sterilize the eggs of the embryonic fish, and then transfer them into sterile media. And then the fish actually have an endogenous yolk that's their source of nutrients for their early development. So we actually don't need to feed them exogenous food. And so it's for the early developmental window, it's actually very straightforward for us to be able to do this. In contrast to, there's some really very seminal work that's been done in mammals such as mice. But making germ-free mice is much more involved. It involves performing cesarean section and a much more elaborate procedure. And so for us, in contrast, it's really just dumping bleach on some fish eggs, and it works.
Wow. How well do the animals? You mentioned that they're not very mature in their defensive systems, but. I mean, can they function reasonably well without microbes in their bodies?
Yeah, so they can function reasonably well. I mean, they do develop, and there's very specific ways in which they have developmental deficits. So we also look a lot at development of the digestive tract. And by and large, that develops normally, but there's certain subtle differences, which we think are very interesting, and they're actually differences that have to do with how the host is interacting with its resident microbes. So one example is that we're just looking a little, well, are all the proper enzymes expressed in the digestive tract that should be there? And we found one example of an enzyme that was not expressed properly. It's called alkaline phosphatase. And what was interesting is this enzyme had been studied for years and years, and a lot was known about it, but it wasn't actually clear so it was known that it could break down and remove some molecules from a larger molecule, but it wasn't known, well, what's the normal molecule it works on? And it was sort of assumed that, well, it's in the digestive tract, it must be digesting some kind of food that the animals take up. And this is an enzyme that's in us and all animals. And but what we actually were able to learn is that the important function of this enzyme in the digestive tract is actually to detoxify a component of the bacterial cell, the bacterial cell wall, that's normally quite pro-inflammatory. And so it's actually serving a purpose to modulate the host immune response to the gut microbes. And the gut microbes themselves are the ones that upregulate this enzyme. So there's this crosstalk between the resident bacteria and the host, where the bacteria are kind of putting into place a system so that the host doesn't have an overreaction to them.
So the body essentially treats them as part of the scenery,
part of the operation. Yeah, and it's this really, so it's this very specific deficit in these sterile fish that don't have this enzyme that is normally in place to deal with the microbes. It's interesting that we're learning that there's these developmental events that happen that are really all about negotiating coexistence.
So how many zebrafish tanks do you have at the Meta Center? I can envision that, you know, tank A, they've got this kind of microbe, and tank B, they've got this kind of microbe, and so forth.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons why this research is possible here at the University of Oregon is that it's actually the home of zebrafish research. It was first developed here by a pioneering scientist, George Streisinger, and it's really sort of the epicenter of zebrafish research in the world. We have the International Stock Center and a very large facility. So we're able to make use of a much larger zebrafish facility here on campus. So there's hundreds of thousands of tanks.
That's about what I was figuring.
Yeah. But one of the exciting things that we've been doing, you know, you said there's tanks with microbe A and microbe B, and we have been able to do that because we've been able to isolate normal gut bacteria from these zebrafish. That was not something that, you know, was sort of readily available. There's repositories of bacteria that microbiologists have collected over the years. And actually, those repositories really are very much enriched for pathogens, for things that cause infectious disease. And there's been less of a focus on just collecting the normal innocuous residents, you know, that. And so that's something that we've been able to do and actually start to study their properties in this way of, you know, in tank A, there's microbe A, and mm-hmm. tank B, there's microbe B.
Microbes and how they function inside the body are a topic of discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Karen Gilliman from the Meta Center at the University of Oregon, Microbial Ecology and Theory of Animals Center for Systems Biology. Join us at 800-838-3760 with questions or comments, or maybe you've got some stories about microbes in your own gut you'd like to join us with. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Those of us who have been exposed to broad-spectrum antibiotics have anywhere near the number and variety of flora and fauna in our bodies that people in primitive cultures have who've never been exposed to antibiotics?
That's an excellent question. There's a lot of research in that area. And in general, there's this observation that individuals in Western societies where there's use of broad-spectrum antibiotics have much lower diversity of their microbial communities as opposed to communities where, for example, looking at hunter-gatherer communities where there's, you know, a much more basic lifestyle that doesn't involve kind of Western medical practices. That said, then there's also been studies where individuals have been followed where they, you know, prior to taking antibiotics and after taking antibiotics. And there is observation that after one course of antibiotics, a lot of the microbes in your digestive tract can grow back. But with subsequent courses, there seems to be greater loss. So we're still not entirely clear what are all the components that would explain this general observation of why there's less diversity in Western cultures, versus other cultures. But certainly antibiotics are a very likely culprit for loss of diversity.
And conversely, then, how much do probiotics help to encourage the growth of the so-called good bacteria? And are they selective enough to encourage the good without encouraging the bad as well?
Yeah, so probiotics is a very nebulous term. It really just means any kind of living organism that has the potential to promote health. And there's a lot of diversity in the kind of probiotics that are commercially available. In general, they're kind of low complexity. They're, you know, maybe a formulation with some lactobacilli. So a single inoculation of that is not likely to cause a lot of diversity. There's definitely a lot of activity in trying to develop more rationally designed probiotic formulations that would maybe have more diverse microbes that could promote health. And then there's a lot of interest in what's called prebiotics, which are basically food to feed your microorganisms. So there's evidence that if you ingest a lot of complex carbohydrates, that can promote the growth of certain bacteria that are often depleted in, you know, individuals on a typical Western diet, which has very low complex carbohydrates. So you could take that as a formulation called a prebiotic. You could also just eat lots of whole grains and vegetables, and that would be the same equivalent.
Back to Mark's question about first world versus developing world, much has been said about the fact that we like to maintain a very clean environment, and that might not be the best thing for us, which is not the same thing as saying, let's go eat dirt, but, you know, are we clean to the point of possibly not helping ourselves very much?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting idea, and I think Mark's question is actually a very astute one. That so there was an original idea called the hygiene hypothesis, that an observation that cleanliness seemed to track with certain diseases like asthma, certain kinds of autoimmune diseases. And now I think there's been more of an appreciation or reformulation of that idea that cleanliness in general might be kind of part of a problem, but that the specific problem might be loss of specific human-associated microbes. So, you know, maybe you don't just need to roll in the dirt, but that it's something like taking lots of antibiotics that would be targeting the bacteria that are associated with humans could actually lead to the extinction of certain bacterial groups that are really beneficial for and you know, potentially have been long associates of humans throughout human history, and now with recent changes in lifestyle and medical practices, we might be eliminating, causing the extinction of some of these kinds of microorganisms. I mean, we think a lot about extinction of macroorganisms on our planet, but there's, you know, we know much less about the distribution and prevalence of microorganisms, and there could be ones that are really important for human health that we're inadvertently killing off.
We're talking about what lives inside us or should in terms of microbes with Dr. Karen Gilliman, molecular biologist and director of the Meta Center at the University of Oregon, which stands for Microbial Ecology and Theory of Animals Center for Systems Biology. A couple minutes left. If you'd like to join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Annette in Eugene wants to know about kefir, if that is all it's cracked up to be as a probiotic.
Well, kefir is actually a really complex microbial community. So, yeah, I think it's a pretty interesting. I mean, some people report that it helps them. I actually culture it at home just because I think microbes are fascinating, and I also think it tastes good. But I think that in general, that as opposed to a probiotic supplement that's going to be really low diversity in the types of microbes that are present, kefir has it's known to be this really interesting symbiotic consortia of microbes and fungi, and it so you're dosing yourself with a lot of different types of things, and it, you know, there's every reason to think it doesn't cause harm, and some people think it is beneficial. So you know, my sense is that you know, if you feel like it benefits you, it's, you know, go for it.
in a real general sense, is molecular biology, there's the understanding of the human microbiome a lot farther along than it was 10 or 15 years ago?
Yes, you know, one thing that's really been a revolution in our field is advances in DNA sequencing technology that have, you know, just plummeted the cost of DNA sequencing and allowed us to sequence much more material. And that's really what's been enabled our ability to describe microbes that are present in complex consortia. So prior to this DNA sequencing revolution, the way that you would enumerate what microbes are present on anyone and, you know, any environment was by trying to individually culture these microbes and interrogate them. And that's very challenging. We don't know how to culture a lot of the microbes that live on our bodies. Now with DNA sequencing, we don't need to culture them. We can just extract all the DNA from a community and just sequence it without having to grow it in a laboratory. And that's really revolutionized our insights into the diversity of microbes that we coexist with. And so that's really been one of the huge revolutions that in this field is our ability to just, you know for the first time who are we living with.
Right. Here's a quick question from Roy in Jacksonville. Welcome to the Exchange. Roy, go ahead.
Hi. Doctor, I'm a chemist, a physical chemist, and I'm getting suspicious of something in the system. When a colonoscopy is done for older folks, typically at 65, it just happens as a routine these days. There's a pre-clean material that's used by the patient that washes out the whole system and cleans it so they can get nice, clean photographs all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, I think it also takes with it the local flora and fauna, just gone.
Okay, let's get a response to see if there's, have you heard anything about that, Dr. Gilliman?
Yes, there is quite a bit of interest in that kind of procedure. You know, there's quite a bit of evidence that a lot of the most important gut microbes are the ones that are closely adhered to the surface of the gut, and so those are not as affected by that kind of a treatment. And I can't quote specific studies, but I know that people have looked at the effect of that kind of cleansing versus not, and there is, I think it's less detrimental than, for example, antibiotics, that there is a regrowth that happens after that.
All right,
so it's not an entire sterilization. So, I mean, one thing to appreciate, that we appreciate from our experimental studies, is it's very, very hard to sterilize an animal, and so a lot of, the things, the routine things, that medical practices wouldn't actually cause sterilization.
Yeah, there's a lot. Just a lot more time we could have spent talking to you about zebrafish and all the other things you're doing up there at the lab. But great stuff going on at the Meta Center, which is the Microbial Ecology and Theory of Animals Center for Systems Biology that Dr. Karen Gilliman runs at the University of Oregon. Dr. Gilliman, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, it's a pleasure. We'll talk to you again down the road.